where the Lance Air story begins. A few minutes with Lance Nybauer. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. We can't talk about the Lance Air, Columbia, Cessna, Corvallis, that whole storyline, without going back to where it all began. And it began with a guy sitting next to me right now. Lance Nybauer started this line of aircraft back in, I guess the first one came out in 1984. Is that about right?
That's right. Yeah, 200.
I want to go back farther than that because in looking into your background, I learned that you had a background in graphic design or got a fine arts degree before this all started. Right. How did the aviation side of this whole thing develop?
Really, it goes back to family. My uncle and Al Myers were high school buddies. And, of course, Al Myers designed the airplanes, the Myers aircraft, and my uncle got them produced. And they had their little company in Tecumseh, Michigan, and we were pretty close. It was my mother's brother, Ray Bessel. So we were out there all the time. And my first ride was in a Myers 200. And then later he took me up in a biplane, the OTW. And, you know, from that point on, we were out there at least every other week. And I would always be asking, when can we go to the airport? Because we'd get to the house, and Uncle Ray would always be at the airport. Mm-hmm. And we'd go down, and he would always give me a ride. And, yeah, that hooked me on aviation right there.
All right. Now, fast forward a number of years to the point in your life where you decide to get involved in manufacturing aircraft or at least facilitating home builders with kits. How did that whole process go? What influenced you to do that along the way?
Well, it was actually my introduction to this organization called Experimental Aircraft Association. And I met them out in Southern California. I was living there at the time. And Chapter 96 had a little demonstration or a little exhibit going on at, I think it was Dominguez Hills College. And we went out there, and I saw their Woody Pusher and met a bunch of the friends there, and they became good friends. And so I got into EAA, and then from that, I started looking at other airplanes to build. I'm a builder. I like building things just in general, houses, boats, planes, cars. But so I ended up building a plans built, a KR-2. And from that, I got more and more interested, and I actually considered a second degree in aerospace and went to Northrop and talked to some people there. And what I was wanting to learn was things that were not really being offered because I would have had 2 years of prerequisites. So I was impatient. So I went to the library and studied structures, and composites were just coming on, and I felt comfortable with composite sculpting, basically. Teamed up with some consultants, Martin Holman for one, and we worked together for years. I would work on the airplane designs, and we would be back and forth over the phone, and he'd come down, and or I'd go up, and I'd be, you know, looking at the structure and how we could actually produce it economically, and he was really cared more just about the structure, and so, you know, it was always a aviation airplane design is a compromise always. So, I mean, so that's how that whole thing got going. And I had this first design that I'd worked on probably for a year and a half. I had a whole fistful of D-sized drawings. And I remember one of the EAA chapter meetings was at my house. And I showed some of the guys the plane on the drawings. And they all liked it and said, boy, if that flies good and can look like that, you might have something here. So I thought, oh, heck, I'll build one, you know. And I just went off and rented a shop and built one. And like I say, the rest is history.
Well, let's fill in one of the steps along the way of that history. You had an art background. Aesthetics were important to you. It takes another whole side of that to make it all work. You mentioned consultants and some self-study. What was involved in the engineering side and making sure you had a safe thing structurally when you got to the point of building the first thing that had your name on it?
Well, that was the consulting engineers that would, okay, that would do all the structure. I built my first prototype with a lot of my own engineering on structure, but that wasn't going to cut it if I'm going to let somebody else go in it. So, yeah, we did a lot of engineering work on it, all through consultants, and it worked out quite nicely. It was a good working relationship that went on for years and years and years.
Now, a lot has happened since the first plane you put on the market in 1984. You no doubt started carving foam and approaching it almost like a sculpture. Now everything comes out of SolidWorks or some other modeling program. What's that transition been like? Because you've seen it from start to finish in your career so far.
It is quite an evolution. I started on drawing boards, and I felt then, and I in some respects I still do, that there's something to be gained from it. Because I could take a bunch of D sheets and spread them out all over the floor and stack them in various stages of, you know, transparency and be able to see the relationships of one thing to another. And that helped me a lot. And I'm a visual person anyway, so I was comfortable seeing that airplane in three dimension on a sheet of paper. Some of the early engineers I would come in contact with, it was almost as if they would have tunnel vision because they're working on a computer, which is much more accurate and has its advantages, of course. But they're looking at it through a monocular, and they see this little piece and that little piece. And oftentimes, if they're not a three-dimensional visual type, they don't really put it together. And you would find that later when we're building a part, you find that, well, this doesn't fit to that. And they never saw that, you know. And so you have to, you know, educate them on that. And now that the things like SolidWorks and Pro-E and all those have gone a little bit further and you're working in three dimension on the computer, that circumvents a lot of that. But, you know, like anything else, it's the mindset that determines what the outcome is going to be, not really the tool so much.
I was looking back in, I think, an old copy of the Bend Bulletin, and saw where you had been scheduled to speak at a luncheon for a group of people in the area. And part of your topic included raising money and starting a company and working your way through what you called the barrier of entry into the certificated aircraft world. How do you feel about that looking back on the part of it you've had to do so far? Is the FAA just really a stick in the spokes when someone wants to advance the state of the art?
Well, there was a time for sure when they were. When we certified the Columbia 300, that was the first small four-seat GA airplane in over 30 years. We dealt with Seattle, which was, you know, kind of nicknamed Aluminum Sky, and the ACO office up there. And they were very cooperative, but they had no real set of data to approach how to certify a small GA airplane, let alone an all-composite airplane. And so it was very difficult. You know, the joke was that the FAA saying is, we're not happy until you're not happy. Yeah. And then there was a lot of that, you know. But, you know, we were the first. And in some respects, that probably made it harder than any others. But, and then we saw the discrepancies between Chicago ACO, where one of our competitors was certifying, and then Seattle ACO, where we were, and, you know, it was not an even playing field by any means. But, you know, a lot of that has been resolved over the last 10, 12 years. That was 1995 when we started this. So it's come a long way since then.
More with Lance Nybauer in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and this is the special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Lance Air founder Lance Nybauer. Looking back on what he started is daunting. There are many aircraft included under the umbrella of Lance Air, Lance Air Columbia, Columbia Aircraft, and now Cessna Corvallis.
The first was the Lance Air 200 with a Continental 0200 that I stripped out of an old Cessna 150, along with everything else I could possibly use on it. It was limited budget back then. But the early customers wanted a little more power, so we did sell a few of the 200s, but mostly they went for the second one, which is a 235. And that had the Lycoming 0235 engine in it. And so it was really just firewall forward change. And then a few years went by, and I wanted something a little bit bigger, and I had, you know, what I thought were probably some better ideas. So we incorporated that into a new model, which was the 320, which had the Lycoming 0320 engine on it, and was the first one with a constant speed prop, a Hartzell, and so forth. And it was a little bigger airplane, and that evolved into a 360, which was really just an engine change. And then I got my feet wet on four-seat airplanes. And that was back in the time when Nick Jones was saying there's no market for a $30,000 four-seat airplane. You know, he had the White Lightning and wasn't selling too well. But I had had this notion that, well, with a family of four, why don't I do this anyway? And then I took the bigger leap to use this brand-new twin turbocharged engine from Continental and put that on it, which was the absolute right thing to do, by the way, but everybody kind of questioned it because we didn't have a lot of working experience at the time with turbos. But that became the Lancer 4. And then I think the 4P next, and we were into the early 90s by then. And the thought was, well, we've got this carbon fiber hot rod of a plane that likes to be at 25,000 feet. Why don't we pressurize it? It's sort of like a big thermos bottle already anyway. And there were only three other GA airplanes that were ever pressurized. And so it was a little bit of a new frontier, but, you know, I try to approach things as simply as possible and just sort of march right in and say, why can't we do it this way? And we had a couple conversations with Lycoming, or with Continental, excuse me, about that, such as using their intercoolers, dual intercoolers, in a dual capacity, not just to cool the air into the engine, but to cool the air into the cockpit too. And they came down and kind of went, well, I suppose you could do that.
Yeah.
And we did, of course, and it worked great. But so we got the 4P, and it was a fabulous plane. It was my plane of choice. I flew that plane for 10, 12 years. It was about the only plane I did fly. And you know, it was and still is a fabulous airplane that set lots of world records. Then we did the ES, looking for a more simplified airplane. And we used components from the 4, but it was essentially a much larger wing, larger tail, smaller engine, and fixed gear. And we flew that with a 200-horse turbocharged engine initially, and then put the 300-horse, normally aspirated Continental on, which became the engine of choice. Mm-hmm. Then came the Legacy, which was a culmination of a lot of things that all the two-place customers had talked about that they would see as an improvement for the airplane. And so I thought, okay, so the Legacy became a whole new airplane, but it was based off the 320. Conceptually, although it was a totally new wing and a totally new tail and a totally new fuselage, but there were a lot of system similarities, you might say. And that was a very successful airplane. And the first one with that also had the turbocharged 200-horse Lycoming in it, and it did real well with that. And then we put the 300-horse Continental in it, and that, again, became the engine of choice. And, of course, Daryl Greenemeyer put a turbocharged, hopped-up 350 in it and won every race I think he entered at Reno in the air races. That was quite the project, quite the airplane. After that, we did a fixed-gear Legacy. And the last plane that I worked on at the kit company was the prop jet, which was the Walter conversion on the Lancer 4P. And that was a very nice plane. That was the last one I flew for the last year or so before I sold the company. But then they've since have gone on and they've got the Evolution now.
In tomorrow's conclusion of our conversation, I get to ask Lance about the current environment for starting a new company in general and the prospects for recovery of what was a promising aerospace scene in Bend, Oregon in particular. If you prefer not to wait, that second installment is available for download now at aero-news.net. The Lancer Kitplane Company lives on, and you can find more info at www.lanceair.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.